which case we're going to have a huge case of special elections across the country.
I don't see that as likely. And there are some folks emailing me about Trump indictments where it's starting to sound a little bit like this. I don't mean this to be insulting, but it's sort of like the Trump people who were saying, okay, before December 13th, this thing's going to be overturned. Well, it's going to be before January 6th. It'll be by the inauguration. It'll be by March, April, early summer, late summer, Halloween, Thanksgiving. And like, it's just not going to happen. I don't think Merrick Garland is waiting for the midterms to indict Trump and his cronies. I just don't. I see no evidence of that. And unless you know Joe Biden's not running for re-election, I mean, either way, I think there's also a risk politically to doing it after the midterms anyway. So I just don't see that as a likely scenario. But I would love to be wrong, and I'm willing to have my mind changed by the facts changing on the ground. We have a tremendous bonus show for you today. We are going to talk about the average workday. Work from home, higher than ever during the pandemic. Workday length, longer than ever during the pandemic. On average, people are working an extra full hour a day. We'll talk about it. Elon Musk has changed his mind, or Twitter has. Elon Musk, after buying a 7% stake in Twitter, will not be joining the Twitter board. And we will also talk about a bill introduced by Democrats, which would require employees be given time off to vote. Some folks thought maybe you had that already, but not in this way. So we're going to talk about all of those stories on today's bonus show. I also want to remind you, David Pakman Show Town Hall 1 week from today, 6 p.m. Eastern on April 19th. It'll be streaming live on the Pakman Live YouTube channel. That's not the main YouTube channel. That's the other YouTube channel, Pakman Live. Everybody is welcome to participate. And lastly, you can now gift memberships at joinpakman.com. If you have a membership already, great. We have almost 700 people waiting for free memberships. You can sign up and check the This Is a Gift box, and we'll give a membership to someone who's waiting. Joinpakman.com, place to do it. We'll see you on the bonus show or other.
Hey there, folks. Glad you could join me for all the best, the smoothest of the smooth, the cool and gentle sounds of what we call jazz.
Tired of the fluffy stuff? At WRCT Pittsburgh, jazz is a one-syllable word.
Holocaust. It's a very serious problem, and one that faces all of us. Fortunately, here at WRCT Pittsburgh, we broadcast from a steel-reinforced concrete basement. So we'll be playing music long after your sorry corpse has evaporated in a blinding flash of light and heat. I hope this thought comforts you. WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Now and forever.
Depose from the faint. Do you think I'm hot? You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
WRCT Pittsburgh. Meaty and full of flavor since 1940.
WRCT. In sound. From way out.
Yo, what's up? How y'all doing out there in Technoland? RCT Techno DJs in the house. Oh yeah, bringing you the only fat beats in Pittsburgh. Right here on WRCT.
concerned with your health and the new USDA organic product standards, WRCT Pittsburgh would like to inform you that all our DJs are genetically modified. For those of you concerned with your health and the new USDA organic product standards, WRCT Pittsburgh would like to inform you that all our DJs are genetically modified to bring you best music.
Disrupting lives. Don't worry, creating heartbreak for people just trying to live their lives as normal New Yorkers. It has to end, and it ends now.
Another mass shooting, this time in New York, as a gunman opens fire on a subway train during morning rush hour Tuesday, firing 33 times. 10 people were shot, another 13 injured. Amidst calls for police reform and gun control laws, what public safety does look like with New York City public advocate Jumaane Williams.
My head train is about to come in. I figured it was important for everyone to see us on the train after that tragedy occurred.
Then, as U.S. inflation soars to the highest rate in four decades, we'll look at the impact of higher prices here and around the world with economics professor Jayati Ghosh.
Inflation is hitting developing countries even harder than it is in the United States, because in most of the world, governments have already not been able to spend enough to actually rescue their citizens from all of the problems of the pandemic. And now that the Ukraine war has led to massive rises in food and fuel prices, people are unprotected and they already had stagnant employment and falling economic activity.
And we get an update from two Starbucks workers on their growing union drive that spread to 200 stores in 30 states.
I'm Madison Hall, and I am a Starbucks barista in Long Beach, California. I am currently organizing my store and have been facing some anti-union tactics from management. This past week, I had a chance to address those concerns with the CEO, Howard Schultz, this past Friday.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Police in New York are continuing to search for a gunman who opened fire on a crowded subway train in Brooklyn during rush hour Tuesday morning. The gunman fired 33 shots after throwing two smoke grenades on the floor of the train. 10 people were shot. Another at least 13 were injured. The New York Times described it as the worst attack in the history of the city's subway system. The shooting occurred in the working-class neighborhood of Sunset Park, which has a large Latinx and Asian immigrant population. Police have identified a 62-year-old man named Frank James as a person of interest in the mass shooting. Investigators say the gunman left behind a bag on the train carrying fireworks, a hatchet, two gas canisters, indicating he might have been plotting a broader attack. They also found a U-Haul key. New York Governor Kathy Hochul spoke outside the train station Tuesday.
The people of the entire state of New York stand with the people of this city, this community, and we say no more. No more mass shootings. No more disrupting lives. No more creating heartbreak for people just trying to live their lives as normal New Yorkers. It has to end, and it ends now.
The Brooklyn attack is just one of several mass shootings that have occurred in the United States in recent days. On Sunday, two people died, 10 were injured in a shooting at a nightclub in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. In Indiana, 6 people were shot, including one fatally at a birthday party Sunday in Indianapolis. And 4 people, including 2 teenagers, were shot Saturday in Washington, D.C., near Nationals Park after a baseball game. Meanwhile, in Georgia, Republican Governor Brian Kemp signed a law Tuesday to allow residents to carry handguns in public without a license or background check. We'll have more on the New York subway shooting after headlines. Russian President Vladimir Putin has said peace talks with Ukraine have hit a dead end. Putin made the comment during a trip to eastern Russia.
And what is most important, the Ukrainian side moved away from its agreement in Istanbul. Now, the requirement for security guarantees is one thing, and the question regarding settlement of relations with respect to Crimea, Sevastopol, and Donbass are to be taken outside the framework of those agreements. So we are again back in the dead-end situation for all of us.
Putin's remarks came as Russia's preparing a major offensive in eastern Ukraine. Putin said, quote, the military operation will continue until its full completion. This comes as the Ukrainian president, Volodymyr Zelensky's, proposed a prisoner swap with Russia after Ukraine's secret services detained Viktor Medvedchuk, a prominent pro-Russia Ukrainian politician who had escaped house arrest in February. Zelensky offered to swap him for captured Ukrainian prisoners of war. The Washington Post is reporting the Biden administration's considering vastly expanding the type of weapons the U.S. is sending to Ukraine. A proposed military aid package worth $750 million includes money for armored Humvees, Mi-17 helicopters, howitzer cannons, and more drones. All this in addition to the $1.7 billion in military aid already provided to Ukraine by the Biden administration since the Russian invasion. This comes as the Pentagon's holding a meeting with the top 8 U.S. weapons manufacturers to discuss ways to keep arming Ukraine if the war goes on for years. In another development, President Biden's accused Russia of committing genocide in Ukraine. He made the comment during a speech in Iowa about rising fuel prices.
Your family budget, your ability to fill up your tank, none of it should hinge on whether a dictator declares war and commits genocide and half a world away.
In recent months, Russian President Vladimir Putin has repeatedly accused the Ukrainian government of committing genocide in eastern Ukraine, where Ukrainian troops and pro-Russian separatists have been fighting since 2014. India is defending its decision to continue importing Russian energy despite pressure from the Biden administration. During a news conference on Monday, India's External Affairs Minister, S. Jaishankar, pointed out Europe buys far more Russian oil and gas than India.
If you are looking at energy purchases from Russia, I would suggest that your attention should be focused on Europe, which probably We do buy some energy, which is necessary for our energy security. But I suspect looking at the figures, probably our total purchases for the month would be less than what Europe does in an afternoon. So you might want to think about it.
Meanwhile, in France, the far-right presidential candidate, Marine Le Pen, has come out against sanctions on Russian oil and gas. In a radio interview Tuesday, Le Pen said she doesn't want the French people to, quote, suffer the consequences of sanctions. In economic news, the soaring price of energy and foods led consumer prices in the United States to rise by 8.5% in March compared to last year. Inflation is now at its highest rate since 1981, this according to a report from the Labor Department. On Tuesday, President Biden visited Iowa, where he announced a plan to suspend a rule preventing the sale of higher ethanol blend gasoline this summer in a move to lower prices at the pump. Environmental groups warn the decision could lead to more smog this summer. The Center for Biological Diversity criticized the decision, saying, quote, the ethanol lobby will be happy and kids with asthma will be sicker, unquote. In global economic news, Oxfam's warning over 260 million people could be pushed into extreme poverty by the end of the year due to the pandemic and rising energy and food costs. Oxfam International said, quote, without immediate radical action, we could be witnessing the most profound collapse of humanity into extreme poverty and suffering in memory, unquote. Oklahoma's Republican Governor Kevin Stitt has signed into law a total ban on abortion in the state.
We want Oklahoma to be the most pro-life state in the country. We want to outlaw abortion in the state of Oklahoma.
The law makes performing an abortion in Oklahoma a felony, punishable by up to 10 years in prison and a $100,000 fine. Reproductive rights advocates say the Oklahoma law is one of the most sweeping abortion bans because there's no exception for rape or incest, and the ban starts at conception. In related news, Yelp has become the latest company offering to reimburse costs for workers and their spouses who must travel out of state to access abortion care. Other companies offering a similar benefit include Citigroup, Match, Bumble, Lyft, and Uber. The number of known COVID-19 cases in the world has topped 500 million, but that number is believed to be a vast undercount. One recent analysis by the World Health Organization estimates the total number of people in Africa who've been infected may be almost 100 times higher than the official count. Meanwhile, new data from the CDC shows more people died in the United States in 2021 than any previous year due to a rise in COVID deaths. The agency said about 415,000 people with COVID died in 2021 compared to about 350,000 the previous year. In other pandemic news, COVID cases continued to rise in the Northeast and other parts of the country. In recent days, a number of colleges have reinstated some form of indoor mask mandates. The list includes Columbia, American, Georgetown, Johns Hopkins, and Rice Universities. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson is rejecting calls to resign after he was fined for breaking UK COVID lockdown rules by attending a party for his birthday at 10 Downing Street in June 2020. Johnson becomes the first sitting British Prime Minister ever to be officially found to have broken the law while in office. Johnson's birthday party was held at a time when the British government was barring residents from visiting sick relatives. British Chancellor Rishi Sunak and Johnson's wife were also fined. New CDC data shows the number of teenagers dying of drug overdoses nearly doubled between 2019 and 2020, then rose again by 20% last year. The CDC found most of the overdoses involved the synthetic opioid fentanyl. The soaring number of overdoses come despite a drop in overall drug use by teenagers in the United States. New York's Lieutenant Governor Brian Benjamin resigned Tuesday after being arrested on federal corruption charges. He's accused of directing $50,000 in state funds to a real estate investor in exchange for campaign donations. New York Governor Kathy Hochul appointed Benjamin as Lieutenant Governor in September after she became governor following the resignation of Andrew Cuomo. Officials in Nigeria say as many as 150 people were killed Sunday when armed men invaded a number of villages in Nigeria's Central Plateau state, opening fire on residents and burning down homes. The attackers are believed to have abducted dozens of people. No groups taken responsibility for the attack. In the Philippines, at least 58 people have died after a large tropical storm triggered landslides and floods in the central province of Leyte and other areas. Dozens of people remain missing. The storm came just 4 months after a super typhoon devastated areas of the Philippines, killing more than 400 people and leaving thousands homeless. Protesters in Sri Lanka are camping out outside the president's office for a fifth day, demanding he resign from office as Sri Lanka faces a growing economic and political crisis. For months, Sri Lanka has faced dire shortages of food, fuel, and medicine. Sri Lanka is on the verge of bankruptcy and announced Tuesday it would stop repaying its foreign debt. And Brazilian presidential candidate Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva has vowed to stop illegal mining in indigenous areas and vowed to roll back rules set by far-right President Jair Bolsonaro that open up more land for mining. Lula spoke in Brasilia, where thousands of indigenous Brazilians have been camped out to protest Bolsonaro's policies.
No one has done more than we have in our relations with the indigenous people. And what's serious is that practically everything we've done has been dismantled. All decrees which have been an obstacle to the protection of the indigenous people must be repealed immediately.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Juan Gonzalez, Democracy Now! Co-host in New Brunswick, New Jersey. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
We begin today's show with the latest mass shooting in the United States. It unfolded here in New York City Tuesday when a gunman opened fire on a crowded subway train in Brooklyn during morning rush hour. The gunman threw two smoke grenades on the floor of the train, then fired 33 times. 10 people were shot, at least 23 were injured. The New York Times described it as the worst attack in the history of the city's subway system. Security cameras at the subway station were not working at the time of the shooting, but riders caught some of the graphic aftermath on cell phone video. The shooting occurred in the working-class neighborhood of Sunset Park, which has a large Latinx and Asian immigrant population. Police have identified a 62-year-old man named Frank James as a person of interest in the mass shooting. Investigators say the gunman left behind a bag on the train carrying fireworks, a hatchet, and two gas canisters, indicating he might have been plotting a broader attack. New York Governor Kathy Hochul spoke outside the train station Tuesday.
The people of the entire state of New York stand with the people of this city, this community, and we say no more. No more mass shootings. No more disrupting lives. No more creating heartbreak for people just trying to live their lives as normal New Yorkers. It has to end, and it ends now.
Meanwhile, New York City Mayor Eric Adams, who's isolating at Gracie Mansion after testing positive for COVID-19 this week, said Tuesday he'll double the police patrolling the city's transit system, at least for now, and did not dismiss the idea of installing, quote, something like metal detectors at subway stations. Adams is a former transit cop. This is Mayor Adams on CBS News Tuesday night.
What concerns me the most is what I've been talking about for several months now, that we have many rivers that are feeding the sea of violence in our city and cities across America. And it's time for all lawmakers to be on the same page, the overproliferation of guns. We removed 1,800 guns off our streets in a little over 3 months, similar to the gun that was used. It's time for us to get serious about the guns in our city, including ghost guns.
This comes as President Biden announced new steps Monday aimed at regulating the untraceable homemade weapons called ghost guns. Tuesday's attack in Brooklyn comes as several mass shootings have occurred in the United States in recent days. For more, we're joined by New York City public advocate Jemani Williams, who's also running for New York governor. Welcome back to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us, Jemani Williams. Can we begin? You were there yesterday in Sunset Park, this working class neighborhood of Latinx and Asian immigrants in particular, many, many essential workers. Can you talk about what you learned and what you understand about the person, not suspect, the police are calling him now, not a suspect, but person of interest?
Well, thanks so much for having me. It's always a pleasure. And of course, on the ground, you know, people are concerned. People are a little stunned. You also have to remember there were schools nearby, one almost directly across the street, maybe a block away, on lockdown because kids were on their way to school. So that one thing we have to remember is the shots are fired and people are physically hit. Thank God no lives were taken. That's just a miracle. But the compounding trauma that happens with people who witnessed it, people who got away, people who were in the car with that smoke, and children who couldn't get out when they wanted to, is long-lasting. And that's one of the things we have to continue to talk about, the compounding trauma that happens when there's gun violence.
And Jemani Williams, what's your response to Mayor Eric Adams's plan now to double the amount of police presence in the subway system, at least as a temporary measure?
You know, we always say that police and law enforcement partners are good for acute situations. This was an acute situation. I understand why people may want to now see additional officers because they want to feel safe and actually be safe. One of the problems we've always said with trying to throw police at every problem is that if it doesn't work, you're going to have to throw more police and then more police and then more aggressive police. And we've been saying for a long time that the answer to the gun violence problem cannot be solely sending police to these to try to deal with this problem. We had a police surge last year. Then we had another one at the end of the year or beginning of this year. We also have new units that are going through streets, and still we're having this gun violence problem. So my hope is that the leaders all from federal, state, and city will finally come together with a more comprehensive plan that addresses public safety. I'm proud to be a leading voice on this issue and have had great experience helping the city get to where it got to in 2018, 2019. We have to do more of what is actually working. This is a national problem. I will say data means nothing to you if you're a victim of crime, to those 10 people that were shot. But other cities are having worse problems, so we shouldn't look to them. We should be looking to ourselves at what was working, what has been working.
And I wanted to ask you about, when you talk about a more comprehensive solution, there's the perception that the public has, especially as the media focus on many of these isolated or these incidents of violence, when the reality is that, yes, there's been an increase in crime in recent years, but it's nothing compared to what it was like back in the 1990s when 2,000 people a year were being killed in New York City. Wondering your perspective, what would a comprehensive plan look like?
That's 100% correct. As leaders, what we have to do is have difficult conversations with the public. And I always, as I said before, data means nothing to the one person who shot, to the people who are in that car, to the 10 people who now have a long-term trauma. But as you said, the media has to be more responsible because we're nowhere close to where we were in the 80s and 90s. And quite frankly, we're still one of the safest cities in the country, even with the spike in crime. But we don't want that spike to happen. We do have a way that we can address this. Many of us have been pushing for the comprehensive solutions for such a long time. As the pandemic was rising, we told folks that while gun sales are increasing, while there are issues of mental health, housing, food insecurity getting worse, we're going to see more violence. Let's get some programs in. We know we have our law enforcement partners, but the more we rely on them solely, the more we're going to see this violence increase. We asked for $1 billion in this state budget to address specifically gun violence and victim services. We didn't get that money, but what we did get is a lot of rhetoric, and we got $1 billion to the Buffalo Bills. That's another conversation. What we need now are people who understand this conversation, who understand how to address public safety in these communities, and really have the courage to have that conversation with the public. But what we can't do is feed the fear the way we are doing and then provide solutions that we know haven't really solved the problem in the past and have caused other traumatic effects on the same community.
So, Jumaane Williams, you're running for governor. It's also being talked about quietly that governor, and not so quietly, Cuomo may be entering the race soon again to run again for governor. But you've put out a housing for all proposal. And I'm wondering if you could be very specific about this, because when we talk about money, where it should go, and there were big issues with what happened at Sunset Park. You know, there's only one exit out, but whoever it was clearly got out, not clear if at that station or someone somewhere else. No cameras working in the area. Apparently, some police officer asked a passenger to call 911, said his radio wasn't working. But what you feel those services have to be shored up? What are the big problems in New York?
There must be. First of all, I always want to say, we cannot provide excuses for people shooting up a train. There has to be accountability, and there has to be consequences for that kind of action, shooting up a street. But what we do say is we can't spend more time on that than actually preventing it from happening in the first place. And so first, Congress has to act. Every illegal gun in these streets were legal at some point. There is too much flow of guns into these cities. We do need law enforcement and interagency cooperation to deal with the iron pipeline of those guns coming in. But what we also know is the intersection of access to health care, access to food, access to better education, access to mental health, access to housing can help with issues that people are having that then lead to higher instances of crime. We put forth a housing plan to help address the homeless and housing insecurity problem that we have. We have a plan to build and preserve 1 million units in New York State over the next 10 years. The governor has a plan to build simply 100,000 units over the next 5 years. That is not enough to deal with one of the boroughs that we have in New York City, much less all of the counties in New York State. And if we don't access these type of things, it provides more pressure for people who are dealing with them. And we do know that the numbers show that more people are dealing with these kind of issues, the more violence that we have. And so we've addressed this in the past. I'm happy that we helped lead the city to become the safest it's ever been in 2018, 2019, funding community programs, funding community groups, addressing many of these social issues. And it worked. We said we should double down on that. We should focus on what was working, not trying to relive and rehash policies of the past that did not work. Our community and our New Yorkers and all of the country deserve to have leaders working on a real plan to address this gun violence, because there are very real victims that deserve it.
Jumaane Williams, I wanted to ask you about the recently passed state budget. Governor Hochul approved a $220 billion budget for the state. The state was probably this year in better financial shape than any time in its history as a result of so much federal emergency COVID money coming to the states and the cities across the country. You've called this budget a colossal missed opportunity that failed to meet the moment. Why do you say that?
It absolutely is. We, as you mentioned, had more money than we've ever had. Yet the issues that I'm speaking about were woefully and inadequately addressed. Even some of the good issues that were addressed, like $7 billion for childcare, which is a huge issue in the state of New York, most of that money is in the out years. Unfortunately, the governor has said she will not raise any revenue for millionaires and billionaires. In fact, she told them that they wouldn't, and she got an extra $20 million over the course of the following week after mentioning that. And she won't address some of these issues because she refuses and says it specifically, I can't fund this because it's not sustainable. It's not sustainable if you don't raise revenue. We have to raise revenue. There's no money in there to deal with the housing crisis that we are dealing with at this moment in time. We got more money for the Buffalo Bills to a billionaire than for gun violence prevention. If you don't raise revenue, New York State is going to continue to suffer. What we had was an ability to meet a moment, to provide a New Deal level commitment to New York State that didn't happen. We told folks when we were running, and people can go to JumaaneWilliams.com and see all of our plans, but we told them while we were running that this current governor was going to be either the same or worse than the previous governor, because this is the space that she has built a career in. Albany has muscle memory. And unfortunately, what we're seeing in the past few weeks with this budget and other news is exactly that. And it's very hard to watch in slow motion, because we know what's going to be happening in the next 2-3 years as we begin to cut the very bone of what people need in the state of New York.
New York's lieutenant governor, speaking of the state, Brian Benjamin, resigned Tuesday. It was shortly after 5 p.m., but his arrest might have gotten lost and earlier in the day in the midst of the news of the mass shooting. But he was arrested in the morning on federal corruption charges, accused of directing $50,000 in state funds to a real estate investor in exchange for campaign donations. I wanted to turn to the U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York, Damian Williams, outlining the charges against Benjamin.
This is a simple story of corruption. We allege that Benjamin struck a corrupt bargain with a real estate developer referred to in the indictment as CC1. Benjamin allegedly directed a $50,000 state grant to a nonprofit organization controlled by CC1. And in exchange, Benjamin received tens of thousands of dollars of campaign contributions from CC1.
He was appointed by Kathy Hochul when as lieutenant governor after she became governor following the resignation of Andrew Cuomo. Again, Hochul is now running for re-election, and Jumaane Williams, you're one of her challengers. Can you talk about the significance of these charges? Most people probably, it might have been lost yesterday given the, you know, global headlines around the mass shooting.
You know, I have to say that there is obviously a presumption of innocence until proven guilty, and the former lieutenant governor has pleaded not guilty. It is always hard, and especially in someone you know, when you see a black or brown person going through this, I do think they have some additional scrutiny on them. But with that said, the charges are really serious, and it's hard to see it, again, as somebody that you know, and those legal issues are very troubling in a space of time where we've seen these kind of issues come up before. What's most astonishing to me is the governor herself saying that she had no idea, even though these issues had come up before, no idea that these legal troubles were going on. That is a key to me, because these are the same things the governor said when she was the lieutenant governor of Andrew Cuomo. And she said she didn't know anything about what's going on when the whole world knew before even the horrors that got him taken down, that his bullying tactics, the shroud of corruption and scandal that surrounded him, that made New York not be governed the way it should be. And to say that again, what it says to me is there's either woeful aloofness that is going on, or embarrassingly, there is some inadequacy and inability to see what's going on in your own space. Or it's worse, you implicitly allowing these things to continue and not saying anything about it. And that is a huge concern, and one of the reasons that we decided to run, because we knew there wasn't going to be much change in Albany. And I'm actually sad to have been right, but I'm happy that we're here to continue to get a message of what New York actually can be for the people who live here, for the working class, the middle class, the struggling. And not what we have been. So we keep saying, in the interest of the tens of thousands of New Yorkers that we lost, the one thing we can't do is what the governor keeps saying, which is go back to normal, which is what we're seeing here. We need a better than normal. We need to normalize people's lives in a way that helps them to live better ones.
We just have 15 seconds, Jumaane, but if you could respond to the news that it is possible Governor Cuomo is going to re-enter the race and he'll be one of your challengers, or you'll both be running against Hochul. Your comment?
I mean, this is what happens when people don't do what they're supposed to do. The legislature should have impeached him. They should look into seeing, trying to impeach them right now. This is the problem. We've been seeing how bad the governor has been for many, many years. People got brave toward the end of his career, when if they had spoken out before, including this current governor, we may not be in this position. And if people had actually went ahead and impeached him, we wouldn't be dealing with this as well. It's sad day for New York if he does do that. And it's dangerous for New York if he does do that. But this is what happens when people enable either explicitly or implicitly.
Jumaane Williams, we want to thank you for being with us, New York City public advocate and candidate for New York governor. This is Democracy Now! Next up, as U.S. inflation soars to the highest rate in four decades, we'll look at the impact of higher prices here and around the world with economics professor Jayati Ghosh. Stay with us. Saya by the Gambian multi-instrumentalist and composer Sona Jabarte. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We look now at the soaring price of energy and food around the world. The U.S. Labor Department said Tuesday inflation in the United States rose by 8.5% in March, the highest it's been in 40 years. Meanwhile, Oxfam's warning over 260 million people could be pushed into extreme poverty by the end of the year due to the pandemic and rising energy and food costs. Oxfam International said, quote, without immediate radical action, we could be witnessing the most profound collapse of humanity into extreme poverty and suffering in memory. For more, we're joined by Jayati Ghosh, economics professor at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, previously an economics professor at Jawaharlal Nehru University in New Delhi, India, where she taught for 35 years, just appointed to the UN Advisory Board on Effective Multilateralism. Her recent article on the increase in commodity prices following the Russian invasion of Ukraine is headlined, Putin's War is Damaging the Developing World. We welcome you to Democracy Now! There's a lot of news in the United States, Professor Ghosh, about inflation, with the numbers just out yesterday, worst in 40 years. If you can talk about that and then put it in the context of the world.
Yes, absolutely. There's no doubt that it is high inflation, and it's much higher inflation, I think, than many people, including in the administration, expected. It's driven really by the fuel prices, and food prices matter, but to a much lesser extent in the U.S. It's dominantly the price of oil that is driving this. There are supply chain issues in a number of other smaller areas like automobiles and so on. But this is a cost push inflation, as economists call it. It's a rise in costs of fuel, which is something that is used in everything else. It's used in the production of many, many other goods and services. It's used in transport. And so it doesn't just affect the prices at the pump. It actually affects all the other prices in the economy. The problem is that then governments say, oh, well, what we have to do is to get the central bank to tighten monetary policy, to raise the interest rates. That's not the problem, because that's not the solution. That doesn't affect the cause of the inflation. So you really have to think of different measures in this situation.
And what parts of the rising inflation, or what percentage roughly, do you attribute to the invasion and the subsequent sanctions against Russia, and what part to structural problems within the world economy in general?
This is a very interesting question, because we know that both these prices, food and fuel, were rising even before the Ukraine war. What happened thereafter is a dramatic and very sharp increase, even beyond the increase that we were already getting. At that time, before the Ukraine war, the fuel prices accounted for about 30% of the increase in U.S. inflation. Now it's more like half of the proportion of inflation that it's determining. But the prices themselves have gone higher than you would expect, given the actual impact on supply. It's absolutely true that, you know, Russia is a major exporter of oil and natural gas, but hey, its volumes of exports haven't fallen that much. They've just been diverted to other countries. It's also true that both Ukraine and Russia are major suppliers of food grain. Ukraine does wheat and oil seeds. They also supply fertilizer. So all of those are impacting food production globally. But the prices have actually shot up well beyond what you would expect through just that supply decline. And that's because there's been very feverish speculative activity in what are called the commodity futures markets. These are markets anticipating the price 1 month from now, 3 months from now. And those prices have just gone haywire over the last 6 months, with massive involvement of speculative activity and then declines in them as they rush out of one commodity into another. So a lot of the destabilizing impact of speculation on what are called these futures markets is impacting the current price, the spot market, as well.
And there's been an economic impact on the global south, obviously from inflation and fueled, as you say, also by the after effects of the war. But there's also been, and this hasn't been noted too much in the media coverage in the West, a sharp divergence in public opinion in the global south about this war versus the public opinion in the West, in countries like Indonesia, some of the largest countries in the world, Pakistan, Brazil, China. Public opinion is much more sympathetic to the Russians than it is to Ukrainians, certainly much more so than in the West. I'm wondering why you think that is happening.
Well, let me take your second question first. I think what is really striking, and I don't think people in the West realize it, is the extent to which the hypocrisy in the sort of moral double standards are evident in this Ukraine war. I mean, yes, it is terrible what is happening. It is a brutal and completely unjustified invasion, and people are dying and people are suffering. But more people have died in Yemen in the last 3 months with arms provided by the U.S. and very, very brutal attacks. People, children are starving in Yemen and in Afghanistan because of U.S. policy. And so, you know, everyone else in the world is saying, how come it's only when they are white Europeans who are affected that you care at all? I think I don't think people in the West realize the extent to which they have absolutely lost moral legitimacy in terms of the very, very different reaction they have exposed in this war to white European lives and all other lives in the rest of the world. This is not lost to anyone in the developing world. There is a very, very strong reaction. And this is going to affect all kinds of things. It's going to affect the possibilities for multilateralism. It's going to affect whether G7 has any standing at all to ask countries to do anything. And it's going to affect whether people go along with the US and Europe in doing sanctions when the US and Europe wants to do it, but not for other equally terrible acts that they themselves are party to. So I really do believe that people in the West need to wake up and realize how much damage has been done to their own conception, very limited conception of, you know, what is moral and ethical, when the rest of the world is very, very evident of what is going on.
I was wondering, Professor Ghosh, if you can talk about the actual corporations, if you could name names of the large corporations that are making a killing off of what's happening right now, that are making huge profits. I mean, we know when it comes to, for example, gas, and many people in the United States have asked, they would say, well, people are paying $5 or $6 because of the war, Russia's war in Ukraine. But it turns out that ExxonMobil and BP, all these oil companies, are making more money right now than ever in their history. If you can talk about the same when it comes overall to inflation and food prices as well.
So this is the whole issue that, you know, once you get some increase in prices, companies see this as a terrific way of quickly making additional profits by raising their prices even more than is justified. So yes, there is, as I mentioned, this cost push element. But what you're also getting is profiteering, plain and simple. So companies, as you mentioned, in the oil sector, companies in the food sector, companies in a range of other sectors are raising their prices much more than is justified by the increase in their own costs. And they can do this because there's a whole atmosphere of inflation expectation. And this enables them to, there are no limits. I mean, this is a time when really you have to have public policy which is regulating companies like this. And it's possible, the governments can do it. You have to regulate the companies that are openly profiteering. You have to set some controls on the prices of essentials that enter into all other prices. And fuel is one of them. You really have to make sure that those prices are regulated and determined. So the notion of this free market is completely false, because these are big, fat as companies, oligopolies that can control the market. And so you really have to make sure that governments regulate those prices. The same thing is true internationally. We are getting the big players in agribusiness raising prices of basic grains and foods well beyond what is justified by the increase in costs. And this is affecting people in the developing world who are already much worse off than those in the US and Europe, who already experienced the pandemic much worse because they had decline in employment, falling livelihood, falling money wages. They haven't had a recovery. Their governments haven't had the money to spend. that has been spent in the US and Europe. They are still well below levels of employment that were there before the pandemic. And now they are facing these huge increases in food prices and fuel prices that really are just going to make massive increases in poverty and hunger globally. So we have to address the problem at the root, which is in terms of the ways in which prices are structured, the companies that are allowed to get away with straightforward profiteering in times of crisis, and bring in regulations and controls that will prevent that.
And in speaking of these protests that have begun to develop, especially in the developing world, in Sri Lanka, there was a mass protest over the cost of essential goods. And on Tuesday, the country stopped its international debt payments, effectively defaulting on its debts. Do you foresee a potential debt crisis across the developing world as a result of this of these inflationary forces?
Yes, absolutely. And this is something we had predicted a year ago, actually, even before the Ukraine war. The Ukraine war has, if you like, accentuated and intensified the problem. But it's not just economists like me. The IMF has predicted this, that if you don't do something about, first of all, the huge overhang of debt that already a lot of countries had, then the knee-jerk response of countries in the North, US and Europe, to raise interest rates, so capital, all the capital comes back to these countries, and then you get massive volatility and capital flight from all the developing countries, you're going to get massive debt crises. This is just the beginning. This is, if you like, the first step in towards the abyss.
I wanted to ask you about the inquiry that you're taking part in today with Progressive International, which was founded by, among others, the independent Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, as well as Yanis Varoufakis of Greece. Can you talk about the inquiry into the IMF and how that relates to what we're talking about?
Well, you know, I think many people in this inquiry are going to be arguing that the IMF has been guilty of many sins of commission and omission. I think the sins of commission are very important, but they're well known. Let me quickly highlight. The IMF goes into countries that are in deep crisis and says, cut public spending. And it's part of the way they are supposed to somehow bring these countries back into balance by saying, you reduce government spending, you impose austerity, and investors will feel more confident. Private investors will then come flocking in. That rarely happens. All that happens is that the problem gets much, much worse. There are many ways in which the IMF has had a very double standard, again, in terms of the rich countries and the not rich countries, the middle income and low income countries. Because in the rich countries, they say, yes, spend more. You have to be countercyclical. You have to revive the economy. In the middle and low income countries, they say, oh, you have to cut down on your spending because you have to reduce your deficit. You have a very large debt. You have to make sure you can somehow reduce that debt in the period of crisis. So in turn, they then demand extra fees and commissions. They impose surcharges on the countries that are worst off, that have had to take IMF loans for a longer period or take larger IMF loans, which is absolutely ridiculous. It's the IMF making profits all out of a catastrophe in all of these countries. So these are the sins of commission, which are very great and have had devastating consequences across the world, really. But the sin of omission, I would argue, is actually even greater. The IMF is the only multilateral agency we have today that handles global finance and can think of international financial arrangements to do with crises, to deal with the challenges that humanity faces. We don't have any other structure. Now, humanity, we know, first there was a pandemic, we know that there could be well more pandemics and so on, but there is climate change, which is, again, already upon us, which is affecting agricultural supply, which is affecting coastal sea rises, which is affecting livelihoods, which is causing already significant increases in environmental destruction, in hunger, in employment loss, in people having to move, displacement, all kinds of things. You have to bring in massive public spending. And the IMF is the agency that can do it. Where is the ambition that can actually provide this minimal funding for the huge climate challenges that we face globally, and which really, again, You can't be nationalist about this. Climate doesn't respect passports and visas. It's not stopping to wait at the border. It's going to affect everybody if we don't do something now. And the IMF has been remarkably unambitious, sluggish, I would say really not doing the minimum that it's supposed to do. It was created just after the Second World War in a very, very, very different world with this power structure that is completely ridiculous now, with the US being able to block everything, US and Europe controlling 60% of the voting rights and all that. But as a result, it really hasn't moved to do the basic things that a multilateral organization that is in charge of global finance has to do. Prevent private finance from doing
it. And you were talking about climate change. You mentioned climate change. How has the eruption of this war affected efforts in various countries? Even in the United States, we're seeing President Biden backtracking on some of his proposals in terms of reducing our carbon footprint. Could you talk about the impact of the war on climate change?
It's very unfortunate that the Ukraine war has shown that whenever there is any immediate crisis, governments across the world are going to not just backtrack, they're going to reverse on all of the commitments in terms of carbon emissions, in terms of moving to greener energy, in terms of everything. So even a war like this, which is, let's face it, a limited war in one part of Europe, is causing everyone in the world to completely forget about all of their major promises and strategies. Some countries going back to coal, some countries emphasizing, you know, the dirtier kinds of fuel, forgetting about all of the attempts, instead of saying, well, look, now let's actually push for greener energy because oil prices are high. Let's push for greener energy. They're saying, no, quickly grab all the possibilities for the dirtiest energy possible. It's the United States, it's Europe, it's India, it's China, it's everyone in the world. No country has actually, or very few countries have actually said, let's use this as an opportunity to move much more directly into green energy sources with public funding, which is really what should be the response. This is terrifying because it means today it's the war, tomorrow it can be anything else. Governments are not committed. They're not seeing the writing on the wall. They're not recognizing the clear and present danger of a climate catastrophe.
Jayati Ghosh, we want to thank you for being with us, economics professor at University of Massachusetts Amherst. Her recent article we'll link to, following the Russian invasion of Ukraine, headlined Putin's War is Damaging the Developing World. Next up, speaking of economics, we get an update from the growing Starbucks union drive that spread to 200 stores in 30 states. Back in 30 seconds.
I'm a union man, amazed at what I am. I say what I think, that the company stinks. Yes, I'm a union man. When we meet in the local hall, I'll be voting with them all. With a hell of a shout, it's out, brothers out, and the rise of the factories fall.
Part of the Union by Straubs. This is Democracy Now! I'm Mimi Goodman with Juan Gonzalez as we turn to get an update on the growing union efforts led by Starbucks workers across the country. The historic movement began when a single Starbucks store in Buffalo, New York voted to unionize in December. Now, 200 stores have filed for union elections covering over 5,000 workers in at least 30 states. Starbucks Workers United has successfully unionized over a dozen Starbucks shops, including in New York, Arizona, Washington, Tennessee, Missouri. And on Monday, workers at two stores in Boston and Brookline, Massachusetts, unanimously voted to unionize. Just last week, workers at the high-end Starbucks Reserve Roastery in the Chelsea neighborhood of Manhattan voted to become the first Starbucks to unionize in New York City. It's one of the largest Starbucks in the world. This all comes despite an aggressive union-busting campaign from the Starbucks Corporation that includes firing pro-union workers in retaliation and forcing workers to attend anti-union meetings. The National Labor Relations Board has called on a ban on this practice arguing it's illegal under federal law. Meanwhile, the NLRB says it's planning to formally accuse Starbucks of illegally firing a group of 7 workers who are fighting to unionize their Starbucks store in Memphis, Tennessee. Last Monday, Starbucks billionaire CEO Howard Schultz spoke out against the unionization drive during a town hall meeting with about 15,000 employees.
Now, here's where it gets a little sensitive, because I've been coached a little bit, but I do want to talk about something pretty serious. We can't ignore what is happening in the country as it relates to companies throughout the country being assaulted in many ways by the threat of unionization.
For more, we're joined by Jazz Brzezak, barista at the Starbucks store in Buffalo, New York, that was the first location in the U.S. to unionize with Starbucks Workers United. Welcome back to Democracy Now!, Jazz. Talk about this. I mean, you guys started it in Buffalo. Now, 200 stores in more than 30 states. Talk about your strategy and respond to Schultz.
Thank you so much for having me first. It's been incredible to see this turn into this kind of national movement. I mean, we've had support from the beginning from partners across the country, and the first store to file after Buffalo was actually a Mesa, Arizona store whose manager was retaliated against for telling us exactly what all of these people coming into Buffalo were actually up to. And when Starbucks retaliated against her and fired her before she had the chance to finish her time at Starbucks after resigning, they were the first store to petition outside of Buffalo. But from there, it's been incredible. I feel like it's almost, I'm not even able to keep up with how many more stores have been launching. So it's incredible to see so many folks. And the first store in the South won a few weeks ago in Knoxville, which was really incredible. The Memphis folks are still, not only did Starbucks fire 6 out of the 7 person organizing committee, but they also have still delayed that vote from actually being scheduled with the labor board. But it's incredible to see more people joining and this movement growing. And I think we all know that that's how we're actually going to get the kind of contract that we can sign and that partners deserve, is by continuing to get stronger and show that despite everything, we keep overcoming that union busting and standing together in solidarity. And I mean, I think it's ridiculous that Howard Schultz is first this threatened by unions, because we've said from day one, you know, we're not doing this because we're opposed to Starbucks. We're doing this because we want to make Starbucks the best that it can be and the most sustainable that it can be. It says it's a progressive company that celebrates, you know, all of these other forms of activism, LGBT rights, environmental justice, Black Lives Matter. And then suddenly it's being assaulted by labor rights. So that doesn't make sense. That's not consistent with what the Starbucks says it is. But I think, you know, we've seen Howard come to Buffalo and make really inappropriate comparisons to the Holocaust, and now we're seeing him say that he's being assaulted. So I think, you know, he tries to acknowledge that it's a sensitive subject, but he's still really missing the mark on how to talk about it.
And Jazz, what's your reaction to the news that Amazon workers at Staten Island Warehouse at the start of this month voted to form the country's first Amazon union?
Absolutely ecstatic. That was the same day as the roastery win, which was really an amazing thing to have both of those coming together. And I think it shows, you know, we as workers and as a labor movement can take on, you know, 15 baristas in a tiny Starbucks or 8,000 workers in an Amazon warehouse, as long as we are standing together.
And finally, the retaliation against workers. We just have 30 seconds, Jazz.
I mean, I think it's been almost a scorched earth strategy. Not only has Starbucks been firing vocal union leaders like the Memphis 7, like Layla in Arizona, like Kessie Fleischer and others in Buffalo,
But they've been slashing hours across the country to try to purge everyone and force everyone to quit or have to get other jobs, and then telling them, oh, suddenly your availability doesn't meet the needs of the business. If we, the only... this is all showing just how much we need a union, because, you know, together we can fight back against all of these things.
Yes, Brzezak, we want to thank you for being with us. Barista at the Starbucks store in Buffalo, New York, the first location in the U.S. to unionize with Starbucks Workers United. And that does it for our show. A very happy birthday to Anna Osbeck, Maria Inez Terracena, Mary Conlin, and David Prude. We have a job opening for a news writer-producer. Check democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
My fellow Americans, I would just like to say now, as an expert on the subject, that WRCT Pittsburgh does not blow. Thank you.
You're listening to Away with Words, the show about language and how we use it. I'm Grant Barrett.
And I'm Martha Barnett. Butter of antimony, blue vitriol, flowers of zinc. Aren't those gorgeous terms, Grant?
Yes, are these crystals?
You're close. These are terms that were used for centuries by alchemists and scientists for various chemical compounds. So butter of antimony is now called antimony trichloride. Blue vitriol is cupric sulfate. And flowers of zinc refers to powdered zinc oxide. And I learned all of this from a wonderful book I just finished called Uncle Tungsten, Memories of a Chemical Boyhood. It's by Oliver Sacks, who's the guy who's probably more famous for The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat. But this is about his childhood when he was fascinated by metals and chemical reactions and the periodic table, and it's also a really good introduction to basic chemistry. But he writes in the book about how that brilliant 18th century chemist Antoine Lavoisier had decided that every substance should have a name that denotes its composition and chemical character. He's the guy who went in there and said, we've got to be more systematic about this. We've got to have names that indicate how these substances would react or behave in various circumstances. And Sacks writes about how he understood that, but he also missed the old names because they had a poetry.
Right, yeah, they do have a poetry, but there's also a mystery about them.
Yes.
All the elements ending in enium or whatever just really doesn't have a... You wouldn't put that into a rhyme, right? You wouldn't sing that as part of a song.
No, you wouldn't put it into a poem, but, I mean, it communicates a lot. It's, you know, it's doing a lot of work, the ides and the eights and the different suffixes and prefixes. But I think we've lost something that we no longer talk about, jovial Bezoar.
Oh, jovial Bezoar. Bezoar being the, what's that, the something found in the stomach of goats, kind of.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
I learned that from Harry Potter, as did a lot
of
people.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, is it in Harry Potter?
Yeah, it's meant to cure poisons, I believe.
Oh, okay. Yes, yes. Now we've replaced jovial Bezoar with Bezoarticum joviale. I'm not even sure what that is. It's some kind of substance. But I think the jovial part has to do with Jupiter somehow. It's some alchemist term, but
so it's not
but
even funny.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, you lose something and you gain something when words change.
Well, at least you can go back to the original sources and enjoy them for what they were. And how is your turning lead into gold coming along?
Yeah, I'm still working on the lead to gold.
Okay. Let me know when you succeed. We'll retire happy. I assume that you'll share the secret with me.
Of course.
We're hoping that you, our listeners, will share your language secrets with us. So what are you thinking about? What's your question? What's your idea? 877-929-9673. Email us words@waywardradio.org or chat us up on Twitter at WAYWORD.
Hello, you have a way with words.
Hello, this is Nancy Nesham. I'm from Berthold, North Dakota.
Hey, Nancy.
Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to be at your show. A few weeks ago, we were visiting our daughter in San Antonio. And I don't know what we were talking about. My husband and she and I were talking. And my husband and I said something about two bits. And she says, it was something about costing, but it was something two bits. And she said, what are you talking about? Well, he said, well, two bits. And she's going, she had no idea what we were talking about. She said, my reply was, you know, two bits, four bits, six bits a dollar, all four, whatever school you were from, you stand up and holler. She'd never heard of this. And so we were trying to explain, where does two bits come from? It means 25 cents. At least that's what we understand. It's a quarter. Where did it come from?
So she'd never heard of two bits?
No, she'd never. She'll be 50 years old, for Pete's sake.
And she'd never heard of shave and haircut two bits?
No, I don't know if she has or not. I guess we never thought about throwing that one. Our older daughter